Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For centuries, three unique pods of orcas have hunted Chinook salmon along the northwestern Pacific coast. Yet wild Chinook salmon here are increasingly scarce. The orcas are going hungry, their numbers dwindling along with their primary source of food, and extinction looms large for both species. The orcas need roughly a million salmon a year, but where are they going to find a million fish? Today, we talk with Stephen Hawley, who's joined by Michael Peterson. They're the writer and director of a new film called Damned to Extinction that looks at the solution to saving both orcas and salmon. That solution is getting rid of four fish-killing dams 500 miles away on the largest tributary to what was once the largest Chinook-producing river on Earth. This is a continuation of the conversation we had with Stephen in late September. Stephen and Michael, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Well, Stephen, you wrote a book a while back called Recovering a Lost River. And my recollection is you mainly talk about taking out four dams on the Snake River, which has been one of your bugaboos for a really long time.
Sure has.
I wonder, how did you make the connection to the orcas and the salmon that are being decimated by those four Snake River dams?
Well, there's a chapter in that book called Feed Willy, play on the 90s film Free Willy. And I actually had read a piece in Seattle Weekly by the journalist David Nywert, and he had made that connection, and I called him and called up. He put me in touch with Ken Balcom, and that was 11 years ago now, and I paid my first visit up to San Juan Island, and Ken had said even then, these orcas are in trouble. There's not enough fish for them. And of course, since then, the salmon situation has just gotten more dire.
Well, it's interesting because I always consider myself somebody who'd been following salmon quite assiduously for many years, and I thought I knew a lot about them, except I started spending a lot of time along the Puget Sound about a year and a half ago and got acquainted with a lot of the local issues there. And of course, the biggest one I became much more aware of was the endangerment of the southern resident orcas. And a lot of people were talking about how they needed to take out these four dams. And I was scratching my head, well, what's the connection? And I quickly learned about it. So what I found that's really fascinating and to me maybe empowering is that the orcas in the Salish Sea, which is the Puget Sound and the other water bodies that go all the way up to above Vancouver Island, that the connection between that region and the Columbia region is really amplified and really explained by the connection between the orcas that live in the Salish Sea or migrate through it and the Chinook salmon who run up and down the Columbia and Snake Rivers. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how maybe this ecological potential disaster is a way for us to begin to understand a broader sense of the ecosystems that we live in. So I'll start with Stephen, and then have Michael jump in.
Well, I think if we could pick a couple of things that we wanted people to take away from this film, it would be that for folks that live inside the region, that the Columbia Basin was once and could be again one of the richest marine ecosystems on the planet. You have salmon swimming all the way up to the spine of the continent, near the Continental Divide in Idaho, and swimming all the way out beyond the continental shelf, making a big circle in the eastern Pacific, sometimes all the way to the eastern side of the Gulf of Alaska. And those marine-derived nutrients really built the forests and the ecosystem of the Pacific Northwest. And we're in danger of losing that and everything that goes along with it.
Well, what are the lessons that the orcas have to show us? Because, I mean, that's one of the ways, that's the way you open the film. And we'll get a little bit more into that in a moment. But there's something about what's happening to the orcas, which a lot of the indigenous people in that area are just saying, basically, they're not just warning us that we're messing up their ecosystem, we're also messing up our own. So what do the orcas say to you, Michael, about what we need to be learning and listening to?
Boy, that they teach us everything. I mean, they been, you know, they're just such an amazing creature. They've got social structures like we do. They live about the same lives that we do. You know, I was just asking one of my favorite orca biologists, Dr. Deborah Giles, who's in our film, about where they have their babies, and they don't have a certain time when they have their children. They don't have a certain place. They're a lot like humans, and so they travel along on the outer coast of the Washington, Oregon coast and spend their time in the Salish Sea, which, as you spoke, is up by Seattle and up towards Canada. And, you know, they just have a lot of you know, I don't want to call them human-like activities because that's a different way
to put it. Maybe we have orca-like activities.
Orca-like activities. But they're just such an amazing creature. They're full of compassion. They play with their children. They feed their young. They have their own language. You know, they're just an inspiration, and they're emotionally attached to everybody that sees them is emotionally attached, and they just have this this magical quality to them that everybody, including the indigenous people, have known for, you know, for eons.
Well, I was thinking last night about what kind of music to go out from the outro for the show. So I have a bunch of humpback whale recordings, and I was listening to them, and I thought, no, you're not going to play humpback whales for the orcas. So I actually looked up and listened to some of the orca sounds, which are very different from the humpback whale sounds that we're much more familiar with. Could you describe the way that they communicate, let's say?
Well, that's one of the most fascinating things about, especially the southern resident orca whales, which the whales we're really focused on right now. And The southern residents have their own language. I mean, you can take a southern resident from the Puget Sound area and take it to like Iceland, and it wouldn't be able to communicate. It'd be like taking me and putting me in the middle of the Sahara Desert. I mean, I wouldn't be able to function. I wouldn't know how to communicate. I wouldn't know how to hunt for food. So, you know, they have their own set of language. And then these pods that we're talking about, the J, K, and L pod, have their own individual dialects between themselves as well. So, for example, one of the dialects, they kind of sound like a kitten. They'll have this meow sound at the end, or they'll have an uptick. And then they have a joint sounds that when they get together, they have these big groups. They call them superpods. That's when all the orcas will get together and meet in the Salish Sea. Usually it's around the summertime. Unfortunately, it's happening a lot less frequently because there's less orcas and there's less food for them. So they're not as relaxed and they don't have these superpods as often. But when they do get together, they would have these shared sounds that they can actually communicate to each other. But so they it's really fascinating, the clicks and the whistles and the squeaks that they make, and it's all different.
What you're describing, the superpod in the Salish Sea, it makes me kind of think of what used to gather at Salila Falls before it was flooded. And I'm thinking, the way you're describing it, it feels like there's a lot of similarities in a way between the way the orcas live and interact with each other and the way that the indigenous tribes in this region, probably all over the country, particularly in this region, how they relate.
Absolutely. That's a really neat connection, because, you know, they do teach their children how to hunt, and they almost exclusively eat Chinook salmon. These are fish eaters only. These aren't the mammal-eating orca whales. And so they, much like, you know, the tribes did for thousands of years, they would teach their children how to hunt. They had their own dialects, and they had their own areas to do this, and they would travel together and meet up in the summertime. Yeah, that's a really wonderful connection. I never thought about that before.
Well, Stephen, I want to talk a little bit about how you got connected with this film. In your bio, your brief bio, you mentioned your book, Recovering the Lost River, and how it was the basis for another movie that Patagonia made a while back. But what led you to do this film, and to do a film that, instead of starting off with salmon runs in the Columbia, starts off with the orcas in the Salish Sea?
Well, it all started because Michael was a stay-at-home dad at the time. I was hiding out in the basement of our house in White Salmon, and Michael was and his young daughter were in a playgroup with my wife and young son. And my wife came home one day and said, "Hey, there's this guy that kind of likes a lot of the same stuff you do. Maybe you guys should get together." So this film got made because essentially Michael and I decided to go fishing one day together, and I mentioned to him that there's a chapter in my book, Feed Willie, is the title of the chapter, that I was interested in bringing to life in a film. And Michael thought we were fishing for steelhead, but I was actually fishing for a partner that day, and he bit, and I reeled him in, and then we made a movie.
Well, I'm kind of a little bit curious about your background, Michael, because in your bio, you mentioned some unusual things for somebody, past gigs for somebody who is so interested in protecting the salmon and protecting the orca and making a movie that so strongly states that position.
Well, and part I didn't even mention to you before, I actually grew up in Eastern Washington in Richland. So I grew up on the banks of these dams. And the thought of ever having them be gone, that was unfathomable to me back then. And I didn't realize the ecological damage that they did until much later. You know, they were just a part of life. They were a part of our culture.
They were a part of the natural landscape, according to George W. Bush.
That's true. You know, and to be fair, I mean, people in Eastern Washington are proud of these dams. You know, they are proud of what they represent, and you know, they're these gigantic achievements, and they agree that they provide green energy, which we can discuss. They're really not all that green after all. But after growing up in Eastern Washington, I went to Eastern Washington University, but then I spent about 20 years in LA making major motion pictures, which was, you know, films like Independence Day was my first feature film credit, and Volcano, where I got to have lava flow through the middle of LA, which Barb thinks we might try and do again. But so after spending 20 years doing that, I just really wanted to have a different lifestyle and do films and do things that actually make me feel a little bit better about myself. I loved my time in Hollywood, and making big blockbuster films is a lot of fun. But I think what I'm doing now, it makes me feel better as a human.
You might be making a little less money, right?
A little less money, yeah. I don't quite have the same paycheck at the end of the day, but my soul feels fuller, that's for sure.
Well, I want to talk about that whole thing about growing up in this landscape of dams. And this was when I moved to Oregon. I was 22 back in 1971. And it was amazing to like live right near the Bonneville Dam, which I'd heard about almost all my life. And the Grand Coulee was somewhere further up, which I didn't get to go visit for many years later. And it was like a real awakening when I learned about Celilo Falls many years after I lived here, or moved here, probably like at least 20 years after I lived here. And to realize, no, the river is not these dams. And I think that it's one of my missions in life since I had that realization, is to help other people understand what the river was in its natural state and how far removed those dams take us from what the river would be as a healthy functioning riverway. And actually, they were building the Snake River dams when I first moved out here, and I used to go out to Idaho every summer and we watched some of the construction of, I think, I remember which dam was the last one that went in after I moved here. But there's something about these, have, in the history of the Northwest, these have been here a very short time, and yet they seem to dominate the culture, the economy, the landscape. So how do we start to reimagine this river system without those dams?
Well, I'd like to make a pitch right now to listeners out there who are free marketeers, conservative economically, because this is a case where market innovation is actually solving the problem of dams for us. It's the case that renewables in California, because of their renewables policy, is changing the way that power is marketed and delivered here in the Pacific Northwest. To tell the story in a truncated form, Bonneville Power Administration, which markets and sells power from these dams for 50 years, their business model was to, the system produces at least twice as much electricity as the Pacific Northwest can use. So they would sell that excess power at market rates to places south of us, mostly California. And they would use the profits from those sales to keep rates inside the region kind of artificially low. Well, in 2008, 2009, California implemented its renewables policy, and now they're making their own electricity for half to two-thirds of the cost that Bonneville used to sell them power for. So the Bonneville Power Administration is in a financial quandary, and they don't often talk about themselves like this, but in fact, they are a federal agency, so we don't really need to worry about them going broke as much as looking at what's happening in the utility business as an opportunity for the region to rethink its relationship to the Columbia River for all the reasons you already mentioned. This is the richest Chinook-producing river system on the planet, and we should probably be trying to restore a semblance of that system for our kids and grandkids.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today we're talking with Stephen Hawley and Michael Peterson, who are the writer and director of a new film, Dam to Extinction, which is going to be playing tomorrow night at OMSI. We'll give a little more details, like the address, which I didn't write down, so I hope you guys have the specifics about how to find it once you get to the OMSI complex. And this movie is really, it's about the relationship between the orcas, the southern resident orcas who migrate through and hang out in the Puget Sound area in the summers. Is that correct, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And they have been a major force, ecological force in the Salish Sea forever. And they are severely endangered. And one of the main reasons they're so endangered is because they thrive on, or they only eat Chinook salmon, which basically run up and down the Columbia River. So we're talking today a lot about how to help the orcas by changing the engineered face of the Columbia River. So let's talk about taking out some dams. Now, we'll start with the ones you've always been ranting about, Stephen, which are those four river Snake River dams. So let's talk about what the problems are there and why it would be so easy to take those dams out, relatively speaking.
Well, they're not needed anymore. It's the most simple answer. You know, they were built actually not for power production. They were built for barging, for river transportation. Every barge that leaves the port of Lewiston leaves with a $21,000 to $25,000 taxpayer subsidy. The only thing they ship is grain. The grain market is changing. Farmers are investing in rail. It would be much cheaper just to pay the farmers to basically subsidize rail transportation to get their product out to port. The power side of it, you know, up until a decade ago, it was a legitimate argument that the dams produce power that wasn't needed inside the Pacific Northwest, but was sold outside the region to, as I mentioned earlier, keep our rates low. That's not true anymore. The dams produce the bulk of their power in the springtime when we don't need it, and Bonneville has this massive glut of electricity that they can't get rid of. It would actually be a financial benefit to the region and quite possibly to Bonneville to get rid of these stranded assets and focus more on modernizing transmission lines, accommodating a renewable energy, wind and solar.
Actually making use of the wind that they shut down periodically because it's too much water.
Absolutely, yep.
Well, I think that one of the misconceptions about the dams, particularly in the Snake River, is that they serve transportation needs. I told the story in September when you were on, but I got a ride with Tidewater Barge a number of years ago when I was doing a documentary about the Columbia River, and I wanted to ride all the way up to Lewiston, which prides itself as being the furthest inland seaport in the world, probably.
Yeah.
And like that in itself is kind of funny when you actually visit Lewiston and see what it looks like, which I'll have you describe that in a little bit.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't give me a ride all the way up to Lewiston because it turns out that boats hardly ever go up there. And it was like maybe once a week that they would actually be sending barges up to get the wheat. And I wound up only being able to ride between Bonneville and the Dalles Dam, which took a long time. But it was interesting to me that they were actually honest about the fact that they didn't really need those dams. It was a sort of an elliptical way of saying that. So this was back in 2002. So it seems to me that those dams have not been needed maybe from the time they were built.
Sure. I mean, since 2002, you have to remember that the transportation sort of frequency on the Lower Snake has declined even further. I can't remember exactly what the numbers are, but off the top of my head, a colleague in Idaho, Linwood Lawhee, calculated, I think, that shipping has declined by 70% over the last 20 years on the Lower Snake. So were the dams ever needed in the first place? Well, that's an interesting story. There was one fellow who was a sort of one-man band that he started out in the 1930s. His name is Herb West. He's really sort of a prototype congressional lobbyist. He moved to Walla Walla because it was his vision to have a transportation system that would put a seaport in Lewiston, Idaho. And he's a lesson in the adage that if you can't get something, you just keep on asking for it, because, and he used every rationale you could imagine from 1930 till the mid-1950s. And finally found an argument that worked, and in the mid-50s, Congress appropriated the first money for the first of those four dams. You have to remember, this is the first two-thirds of the 20th century, we built 30,000 dams in the United States, pretty much thoroughly plugging up every major river system on the continent. And concrete has a lifespan of somewhere between 60 and 80 years. And the American Society of Engineers has told us that our infrastructure maintenance across the continent, including dams right now, is, you know, we're failing. I don't know if anybody saw the article in the Oregonian yesterday about the 1,600 smaller dams around the state that are in danger of failing. Well, you know, concrete and big dams ages just as quickly as concrete and small dams, so we need to really be rethinking our relationship to water at a time when the strain on that resource is greater than it's ever been.
You know, sometimes people will ask, well, these fish that we're talking about, the salmon that spawn all the way up in northern Idaho, they have to navigate eight dams. But we're really focusing on these four on the Lower Snake, and why is that? And that goes back to your question before. I mean, and it's because these four on the Snake really are the most egregious offenders. They proportionally kill more fish than anything else. And the reason, a number of the reasons, but one of them is the Snake River is shallower, so it heats up more. And it's really the outgoing smolt, the small fish, that have the trouble. Climbing the fish ladders isn't as difficult, but the outgoing smolt, when they hit that slack water, it's very warm. The predator fish are in there. So proportionally, these four lower Snake River dams kill more fish than the rest of them. They economically don't make sense anymore. So why keep them?
I have this strange vision about how far removed this culture has come from living with nature and the indigenous ideals that dominated this part of the world for many, many thousands of years before white settlers came here. But I spent some time at the Grand Coulee Dam a number of years ago, and there's a laser light show. I'm not sure they still do it, but they had this laser light show, and I was there. It was around 1999. And the thing, it was weird. It was really funny. First of all, the voice of the river was a guy. I understand that the indigenous people think it's a woman. And that this voice of God, which sounded like a Walt Disney movie from the early 50s, was talking about how that there was all this fertile soil that could be, you know, wonderful for farming, but God put the river in the wrong place. And so it was up for men to move the water from the river to through the coulees, right? Basically through the Grand Coulees to and create the lake. I can't remember the name of that lake that's there. Those little fingers, the coulees.
Yeah, I saw that show. It basically made the case that the river was like a reckless teenager and it had to be put inside these, you know, strict walls before it could become an adult and actually start serving the needs of people. It was very strange.
Yeah, and they were still showing this. I think, you know, I was up there, it was about maybe 20 years ago, and that was a little bit alarming. Then the other piece of that, there's this guy who, I don't know where he is now, but he was in the Dalles and doing a lot of work with actually getting the gorge protected as a scenic area. And he talked about this weird irony that we have this river system now where we send wheat down the river and we send salmon in trucks along the highway to bypass all these dams, and that's considered normal. So that's kind of, in a time where a lot of things that are weird that are becoming normal, that shouldn't be normal. I mean, I think that maybe that disconnect is the beginning of one of our problems. And I wonder how we can get people to not think of these things as being normal and understand the incredible ironies and basically discrepancies with anything that would work realistically.
Well, on a unfortunate and very sad, you know, note, we're seeing the death and the extinction of species because of that. You know, that's why the orca are in trouble. That's why the salmon are in trouble, because Wild is important. It's important for things to be wild. And that's a quote from a director of the recent film Artificial. You know, I was talking with him the other day, and I'm like, what do we want to take away from this? And Josh said, well, wild is important. And, you know, when you put a fish in a truck or in a barge or shoot it over the dam in a cannon, which is something they're trying to do now, that's not working. That's not the way it's supposed to be. And if we can leave it alone, it works just fine.
Well, I was talking with a friend last night. We're having one of those gloomy discussions about climate change and the end of nature and whatever else. And he was talking about how, well, there's this technology that they're developing that can get carbon out of the atmosphere. And my partner and I are looking at him like, I don't know what they are, but I wouldn't trust it. But there is a technology we can use. It's called planting trees.
Yeah. Right.
And I mean, that to me, when I keep hearing young people, I mean, that's one of, there's a youth group, I think it's, I forget the name of the group, but their goal is to plant 1 million trees, which is just the beginning, actually, of reforesting the world. But I find that young people get it. We need to plant trees. But I wonder how we get to that place where we're looking in terms of things that we can actually fix. And this is where, in your film, you make it sound like taking out those Snake River dams is actually low-hanging fruit as far as really solving this problem.
It is. It's probably time region-wide to start thinking about some long-term planning. Indigenous Peoples Day was it, you know, earlier in October. I guess November now. It's last month.
It was a month ago.
A month ago. And the Yakima tribe and the Lummi tribe got together at Celilo Park and called for the removal of John Day, the Dalles, and Bonneville dams. And of course, the press and conventional wisdom looks at that as sort of a crazy idea. But we have the technology, the basic economic justification is there to start thinking about getting rid of some of even these larger projects. It's not something that we should take lightly. There are other ways to produce power, and the reality is there's only one way for fish to get up and down the river, and that's for the river to run free. Just as the easiest way to keep carbon out of the atmosphere is to plant trees, one of the easiest ways to guarantee healthy water is to get rid of dams.
Well, one of the things that I heard, I mean, I've had many conversations about taking out, particularly the Dalles Dam, though I understand when I started learning more about what lies under Bonneville Reservoir behind the Bonneville Dam, that there's some pretty amazing geological and hydrological formations there we'd probably be happy to see again. But the answer, I mean, when you throw out those things, at least when I would throw these out to people 20 years ago when I was first working on these issues, they would say, but we need the power. And I remember one time I was actually giving a presentation of my project about the Columbia River. I was giving it out in Astoria and talking about the need to take out dams. And this woman said, well, what do you want? You want coal-fired plants like we have in Ohio? And it was like, you don't understand what the air is like if you went back to coal. And I was like, I don't think coal is the answer either. But how do we deal with these arguments that this is green power, that the dams provided a renewable source of energy, and that's why the Northwest is in such great shape, because we use mostly hydropower, which is actually not true. But
well, first of all, hydropower is not green. Every reservoir on Earth that's created by a dam produces large quantities of methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas that's about 80 times more powerful than CO2. And there's a huge debate going on right now in climate change policy-making circles about whether dams should be given any credit in a carbon market scenario. And the science says no. So, and then, you know, here's the other part of it. Besides what's happening on kind of an atmospheric level with reservoirs, there's the obvious and observable widespread damage to habitat. You know, so think about this, Barbara. If I come to you tomorrow, if dams are so green, think about this. So I got this idea for a new power plant. It has a 140-mile-long footprint, right? It produces significant quantities of power about 3 months out of the year. It creates a huge fish and wildlife mitigation program that costs $1 billion a year. Oh, and by the way, because of the way power markets are working on the West Coast right now, all the power that's produced by this project is going to be surplus to the system. Would you invest in something like that?
No.
Right. Well, that's what the Lower Snake Dams are. So, you know, their time has come and gone.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Stephen Holly and Michael Peterson, who are the writer and director of a new film, Dam to Extinction, which talks about ways to save the salmon, and by saving the salmon, saving the orcas. Before we talk a bit more about your film, I want to continue that the visualization you have of this ridiculous boondoggle project, which is the Four Snake River Dams, but I want to extend it now to the main stem dams on the dams on the main stem of the Columbia. Why do you think that, or do you think it's feasible to actually start considering what the tribes were calling for on Indigenous Peoples Day to take out three of the four dams on the main stem of the Columbia?
Well, two thoughts. One is that part of what we try to accomplish in the film is making the case that this is not only an environmental issue, it's a human rights issue, and that, you know, the river tribes that have spent, as you mentioned, thousands of years, you know, with salmon at the center of their religious and cultural and economic lives have been guaranteed rights to take fish from the Columbia in treaties that were made 150 years ago, and that those treaty rights have been not only ignored, but sort of in a hostile way run roughshod over. That's one part of it. The other part of it is a more, I guess, practical economic argument. All over the world, starting with our neighbors to the south in California, and internationally, if you look at what's happening in Germany, it's not only fossil fuels that are being made obsolete by the move towards solar and wind. It's this whole model of producing electricity in a grand, you know, gargantuan centralized production facility like a dam or a coal-fired plant, and then thousands of miles of transmission lines sending power to far-flung locations. That one of the things that renewable energy has made possible is a distributed energy network where power that is consumed is made closer to the point of consumption. And that's sort of the basics of distributed energy. So I might have mentioned this last September because I think it had just happened, but the city of Los Angeles has just contracted with a major solar company to install an array that's going to serve 1 million of its customers. You've got, starting in January of this year, every residential construction in the state of California was going to be required to have solar panels on it, and California is building 1.3 million new homes in the next decade. What's happening in the Pacific Northwest is we are going to miss out on this energy revolution because of our blind, slavish adherence to the, to hydropower. And the time is now to start getting on the bandwagon for what's happening to energy systems in the 21st century, because this is an antiquated system. Dams are 19th century technology. We can do better.
Actually, I have interesting conversations with my friends up in the Puget Sound area about when we talk about renewables, and we talk a lot about frack gas, which is the fight that's really big right now on the Pacific Northwest, and they talk about how they have green energy because it's hydro, and they have a public utility district in Tacoma, and so when they use electricity, it's good, but when they use gas from Puget Sound Energy, it's bad. And I've mentioned it a few times, well, actually, I don't think these dams are quite so good. So let's make a good argument right now for why we should be getting rid of dams, and it's both in terms of feasibility of doing it and why it would be beneficial. And I want to go back to something you said, Stephen, about how the reservoirs behind dams actually are huge methane producers. I just want to know a bit about the science of how that works.
Well, this all started 15 years ago. There's a expatriate American researcher down in Brazil named Philip Fernside, who studied a major new dam project in Brazil and published research that showed this dam was producing about the same amount of methane as a large coal-fired facility. And this started a firestorm, a lot of debate, a lot of resistance inside the hydropower industry. But of course, like any scientifically compelling idea, his research has been repeated all over the world. The Corps of Engineers has actually endorsed this idea that every reservoir produces methane. There was a huge sort of metadata study done by a consortium of researchers from Europe and a couple researchers from at the Vancouver campus of Washington State University. And they used to think, okay, it was only tropical reservoirs where there's a lot of vegetative material, or maybe it's only shallow reservoirs, you know, up in the boreal forest in Canada. But in fact, we know now that every reservoir in the world produces some level of greenhouse gases. So it's not this clean, green technology that we should be embracing as a way to combat climate change.
Well, another thing, when they build dams and flood giant areas, they're also taking out a lot of forests in some areas, and particularly on the west side of the Cascades. So what, I mean, how do you see that that is another problem with dams? I mean, one of the concerns that I started having when I was discovering the dams didn't really belong here was understanding just how much damage they wreak on the landscape. And we were talking before we went on the air about the North Bonneville power station that they put up back in the 80s. And one of the things I remember, that was one of the few cases along with Hanford when they threw people off of the Hanford Reservation where white people were being displaced because they had to move the entire town of North Bonneville. And the old one had a little more charm than what the army barracks that they put up in the 80s. So let's talk about what happens when they build a dam and how much displacement, not just for wildlife, but also for human beings.
Well, let's start at the global scale. The dam building frenzy in the 20th century has drowned a landmass approximately the size of California. So we've lost that much land. And, you know, the old joke about land is valuable because they're not making it anymore. Well, that's true. So why put a bunch of it underwater to put it on a more regional level? When the Lower Snake River dams were built, you lost about a little over 20,000 acres of rich riparian upland game bird habitat. There was, I think, 22 towns that were, you know, had to be relocated. Some really rich orchard and farmland for those entrepreneurial wine grape growers in the world. This would be some of the finest, what's the French word, terroir, in the Pacific Northwest, if we could bring it back. And as a matter of fact, you know, 20,000 acres of rich farmland in an era where we have agricultural challenges facing us, you have rich soil and a supply of water right next to it. You know, one of the things that maybe hasn't been done yet in the Remove the Snake River Dams campaign is really a blueprint or a vision for what the 140 miles that's been drowned could look like. I don't think anybody's anticipating this being a wilderness area. There should be farms, there should be towns, there should be industry, and there should be clean water and a free-flowing river. And for the 21st century, I think that's a much more compelling vision than 140 miles of slack water reservoirs that are too hot for salmon to swim in all summer long.
Well, we've had quite a few examples in the Northwest in the last number of years of dams being removed. And the one that's closest to us, I think, is the White River Dam. Let's talk about that, because that's where you guys live.
Actually, I can see that from my deck of my house. That's the Conda Dam on the White Salmon was removed. Yeah. And, you know, it was really fun to actually live there before and after, because I've seen salmon spawning now where they haven't been in 100 years. And I'm also really excited because as of now, they haven't planted any hatchery fish behind the river. They're just seeing it recover naturally, which is just fantastic. And it's an extremely healthy river. I go down there almost every day and fly fish in the summer. It's got an extremely healthy trout population. There's a steelhead population. There's a salmon population. And again, unfortunately, economically, that's the reason they took it down. You know, FERC mandated, that's the federal
Energy Regulatory Commission, yeah.
Mandated that fish had to be able to get from the top to the bottom. The owners of the dam said, well, it's too expensive for us to put in some kind of fish passage, so we're going to just simply take it all out. And now we have a free-flowing river, no longer this stagnant, you know, hot pool full of algae and growth, we have a free-flowing cold river, and it's extremely healthy, and it's been an incredible success story. And I've been able to look at that every day. I looked at it this morning as I was leaving.
Well, a number of years ago, we had a friend who had a cabin, one of those, they owned the cabin, but they didn't own the land it was on, and it was right above the White Salmon River, and right above, this was Northwestern Lake.
Northwestern Lake.
And we spent the weekend there, and I was scratching my head the whole time going, why would you want to live on a flat water reservoir? And I've visualized what it must look like there now, because one of the appeals, and this is the where you get people getting entrenched about not wanting change, one of the appeals of that cabin was right on the water. And at the time when we stayed there, we knew that that dam was going to be coming out in the next year or so. And it was going to be kind of mud flats. It wasn't going to be that nice for a while. And they weren't going to have a great access. And they got to take off their, you know, their boat dock wouldn't work anymore. So what if people who lived on that, quote, lake, how are they adjusting to the fact that they no longer have waterfront property?
Oh, my goodness. You should see it now. I mean, it's not a mud flat. I mean, there's trees that are 6 feet high. The Yakima Nation's done a really great job of replanting the native plants in that area that where the reservoir was. And there's a wonderful trail now that didn't exist before, which Steve and I just walked a couple days ago, which goes a couple miles down. And it's a beautiful, free-flowing river. And I would much rather live on that than a slack water.
But the fishing
reservoir.
Is no good, right? Fishing
no,
is no good.
Nobody else should ever go there. It's horrible.
Fishing's terrible.
Okay,
don't fish the white salmon.
We'll talk about how to even get there. Well, another famous dam or infamous dam that's coming down because it was too expensive to put the fish ladders, all the dams on the Klamath River that were part of these contentious water wars. So let's talk a little bit about that, Stephen.
Well, I think if you could make a deal to get dams out on the Klamath where water is very contentious, you could make a deal anywhere. And in fact, there's a movie made by ex-Oregon state legislator named Jason Atkinson. He made a film called The River Between Us, and it's just basically the story of how this deal was made. And it involved parties coming together and moving beyond their territories and their differences and saying, hey, what if, you know, what if we could envision the Klamath River that still gave everybody what they need, not necessarily what they want, but what they need? Could we have a Klamath River without dams and still have a Klamath River with farms? And the answer to that question was yes. The problem, the difference between the Snake River dams and the Klamath dams are manifold, but probably the most significant difference is the ownership. Another Oregon politician of some repute, Ted Kulongowski's top aide, Mike Carrier, told me once, the Bonneville Power Administration is the worst of the private sector and the worst of government rolled into one. And so one of the things that has to happen if we're going to make the Lower Snake River run free again is people are going to have to start paying attention to the half-truths that the Bonneville Power Administration, sort of the mythology around hydropower that's dominated the region for the past 50 years.
It's interesting because I've been spending a lot of time trying to debunk the green, clean image of frack gas, which is, yeah. And that's easier to debunk, but people who are very strong environmentalists and fighting fossil fuels still don't question hydropower, I think.
Well, let me give you one example here of what I'm talking about. Bonneville Power Administration has been throwing out this statistic to their constituents and politicians that the Lower Snake River dams produce hydropower for $11 a megawatt hour. That's just not possible because Bonneville is required by law to sell power to their PUD customers at what it costs them to produce it. And I think those PUD customers would be shocked to learn that Bonneville can produce power for $11 a megawatt hour, but yet that's not their cost. They're selling it to them for $37. So if they're able to produce power that cheap, that's what they should be charging their customers. And in fact, they're not. And I don't know what formula they're using to calculate that cost, but it's clearly not taking into account sort of reality.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Stephen Hawley and Michael Peterson, who are writer and director of the film Dam to Extinction, which I'd like to start talking about now some more. So first of all, I just want to know, what was the motivation for making the film for you, particularly your part, Michael?
Well, Steve jokingly said, as we were floating down the Deschutes River one day, he was, there's a chapter in my book that I'd like to bring to life in a film because people don't read anymore. So we need to make a movie about this, which I think people still do read a bit, but the movie has reached a lot of people. And, you know, growing up, like I said, in Eastern Washington, the dam issue was something I didn't know a lot about from this side. And I had no idea the incredible damage that these massive structures do until I really started researching it. And I have to say, it's converted me into somewhat of an environmentalist and activist for these dams, because for removing them, because they're so destructive and they're not necessary. And the human element of the movie, you know, we talk about in the film scientists that have been studying the whales for 40 years and people that have been in love with the salmon on the east side of the river and the west side of the, you know, the state, as well as people like we have a Carrie Nightwalker Schuster, who's in our film, whose family land was actually flooded when they put in Ice Harbor, and they lived on the river. And it's just it's a heart-wrenching part of the film.
Ice Harbor is what, just so people who don't know?
Oh, Ice Harbor Dam is a dam on the Snake River. And when they put that in, her family land was flooded, and she watched the logs that she played on as a little child float away as the police came and physically removed them from their land. And so the negative effects of these dams on a human level and on an economic level and on any environmental level, it's massive and so destructive.
Actually, it makes me think about stories, particularly of the tribes talking about what it was like to watch the backwater of the Dalles Dam be filled and to watch and hear, mainly to hear Salalah Falls be silenced. Ooh. And so I think that's one of the things that we need to reemerge. I mean, I think in terms of like before we can take the dams out, to like be able to take them out mentally so that we can really understand what has been disturbed. And I like the idea of doing it through personal stories.
I think about the story about Chief Tommy Thompson, who was a Wyom Indian, sort of the chief of Celilo Falls, and he was in a nursing home. And that day in March 1957, when Celilo was covered up, and as it was being covered up, he said, you know, the water is covering me up. Give me a blanket. I'm shivering. So that's how deep his connection was to those waters. And I, you know, there are relatives of his and other First Nations Columbia River peoples that have that same connection still.
I'm thinking about, I've been to a lot of rallies and marches up in the Salish Sea area in the last few months. And one of the two strong images at every rally, there's people carrying salmon, there's people carrying orcas. And this is actually for rallies trying to stop frack gas projects. So I just want to how do you see that connection? Why are the orcas and the salmon marching with people?
Well, we have to think about the connections, right? These are all energy systems that are doing tremendous amount of damage. We know, because of the science of climate change, that we have to fundamentally reform the way that we produce and consume energy in our economy. And again, the culprit in the energy sector of the economy is this model where you're producing power in a centralized location, lots of it, and sending it a long ways away. And fossil fuel power plants and hydropower plants have that in common. It's a model that perhaps worked well in the first part of the 20th century. We don't need it for the 21st century. These are just investments that we need to make because they're practical and they're economical, but also because they are morally sort of an imperative if we're going to continue through the 21st century in a way that, you know, allows us to lead happy, healthy lives.
I'm thinking about this vision that I heard from this wildlife biologist. He was working with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission back 20 years ago when I was first starting to work on the Columbia River projects. And he was describing, he had this idea of having all these tiny little dams across the Columbia. They would not help shipping at all, but you could get electricity generated from them, and maybe even a little irrigation, but it was mainly thinking about electricity. And it would be like hundreds of little dams. And the model was a dam like the one, it's at Brighton Bush Hot Springs that crosses the Brighton Bush River, which I think is about a foot high. Do you think that that's another model to play with?
That's been studied. I think that's called an impeller, where you just have something that goes with the flow of the river. It turns a smaller turbine, and it has some promise for rural places, small populations. But I think in New Zealand or Australia is where they've really tried to scale this up.
But not on a river the size of the Columbia.
Not on a river the size of the Columbia. It probably wouldn't be as practical. You know, and again, the solar, wind, and the emerging technology of storage from those generation, from those renewable sources is really, you know, what's going to happen if, as we sort of perfect storage technology, is that one of the rationales that the, you know, Bonneville Power Administration offers for keeping hydropower is that we need these, what they call spinning reserves. So when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine, you need to be able to flip a switch and produce power in a hurry. Well, thanks to Tesla and other sort of innovative companies, if you're able to store power from solar or wind, you don't need spinning reserves. You don't need a huge hydropower dam to back things up, because you'll have some form of storage technology that will take the place of that.
I was thinking of one other argument that's made, that's flood control. So how do we, I mean, and people will point to the Vanport flood as an example of why we need to have the dams.
Well, one of the other mythologies about the Columbia River hydro system is that it provides flood control. It doesn't. Grand Coulee Dam is the only one that offers that possibility. The rest of the dams are what they call run-of-the-river dams. They're built for maximum power production and navigation, so there's no flood control.
Well, you start the film with the story of Tahlequah, the very famous now orca mother who pushed her dead calf all in many cycles or circles around the Salish Sea back in summer of 2018. So I wanted to end with that story, and I won't give away any more about the movie besides that. But why is that story so compelling? What was shown to us when Tahlequah displayed her grief to the world?
Well, I think Michael and I have had many discussions about sort of anthropomorphizing what animals do, particularly these orcas. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that they're like us, but they're different. But I think this was a case very much so where the orcas are like us. It was very clear, even to the most stoic biologist, that what was going on is a mother displaying her profound grief for the loss of a child, for the loss of this calf. And while it was tragic for the orcas, because it was something that was like us that we could identify with, it also caused this outpouring of grief. And it sort of reminded me of Paul Hawkins' idea that activists are sort of the immune system of the planet, that this terrible thing happened to these orcas, but yet it caused people to sit up and pay attention. It was a major factor in a petition that now has 780,000 signatures aimed at the Washington governor's office, asking him to give some serious and urgent consideration to dam removal. So,
is he paying any attention?
No. No, I shouldn't say that. Inslee has done something that no governor has done in the region so far, is that he's put together a task force. However, politics being what out of that task force evolved this kind of what if. And I guess you could make an analogy. It's the same sort of what if that happened that started the Klamath Dam removals. But because hydropower interests in the Columbia are so entrenched, this what if panel that Governor Inslee has put together is going to be as hotly contested by interest opposing dam removal as anything that happened on the Klamath. So folks really need to weigh in. I think that's what will make the difference here. You know.
So how do they weigh in?
Get involved. There are a number of organizations. If you go to our film's website, www.damntoextinction.com. We list a number of organizations that are working on this issue. Early next year, I believe in February, the federal draft plan for recovering salmon on the Columbia will be issued. It's going to be a dog, not a pony, so people need to express their dissatisfaction with that and just keep moving forward on this issue. There's been so much progress that's been made in the last decade on this, and we just got to keep pushing the momentum.
And we'll keep talking about it on the show. So how do people get to see your film tomorrow night?
This is really exciting. Tomorrow night, we're going to actually have it at the at OMSI here in Portland, which is 300-person theater, 80-foot wide screen. So you're going to see some gigantic orcas.
Larger than real life.
And see, actually, larger than real life, which is very exciting. The doors open tomorrow at 6:30.
And where is this exactly?
It is exactly at 1945 Southeast Water Avenue, Suite 100 in Portland, Oregon.
If you get there early, Annie C., who produced some of the music for the film, is going to be playing before the film. It's worth coming just to see her. And I think we think you'll like the movie, too, if you stay for that.
And that she sings the song at the end of the
movie. Yep. Yes, she
it's
does.
A beautiful yeah. song, yeah. And one other thing, because my experience is going to OMSI, is parking is very weird.
Yeah, come
so,
early.
So it's, but also, it costs money. I'm assuming it costs money to park in the lot at night. But
ride your bike.
Yeah, right. Okay. Good idea. Good headlight. Well, anyway, it's great to talk to you guys today.
Thank
and
you.
Looking forward to seeing your movie again tomorrow night. So once again, Damned to Extinction will be at OMSI. The doors open at 6:30. The movie starts at 7. And it's a movie made by my guests here today, Stephen Hawley and Michael Peterson. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks
for having us.
And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll talk with another person from down there in the Hood River White Salmon area of the Columbia River, Susan Hess, who is with an environmental web magazine called Columbia Insight. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Jorma Kekkonen, who was once the lead guitarist with Jefferson Airplane, a tune called Embryonic Journey. Thanks for listening.